Welcome. This is the Woodbury Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. We're glad that you tuned in, and if you'd like to know more about our church, you can find out all the information at woodburychurch.org. Or we'll see you some Sunday. Sundays at 10 a.m. Looking forward to it.
I'm just going to start off by saying this. I think most often, we know what we should do. We have just figured out many reasons not to do it. We know what we should eat. We know when we should go to bed. We know that we shouldn't keep watching the Netflix show. We know that we should really go be friendly to our neighbors. We know that we shouldn't procrastinate. We know all those things. We just usually need some sort of swift kick in the pants to make it happen. You know what I mean? And everybody's wired a little bit differently. Some people, I don't mind it when somebody comes up to me and is like, Patrick, you can do better. And I'm like, yeah, that energizes me. I've discovered that for some people to say, you can do better, it totally demotivates them. They're like, oh, you think I can do better? Well, I'm going to prove to you that I cannot do better. And other people, you tell them that they can't do better, and that totally energizes them. People are so weird. It doesn't make any sense. But truth of the matter, no matter how it comes, we often just need some sort of kick in the pants. I think that's a theological phrase, by the way, kick in the pants. I was about 11 years old, my family decided to move overseas to Taiwan. They were going to do some missionary work. My uncle gifted me a journal, and he told me, real seriously, I mean, he's a good guy anyway, but real seriously, he said, Patrick, you need to keep a record of this experience. You know, you're one of relatively few American teenagers that gets to go and live overseas. You need to write down what's happening and your recollections and your memories and the things that take place. You need to write that down because you'll treasure that. You'll treasure those memories because we forget so much. And he gave me this journal, record everything. You'll value this forever. Maybe you could even turn those journal entries into some kind of memoir, some sort of bestseller, right? You know, an American in Taiwan. I don't know, something like that. Well, I still have that journal, and I'm going to read it to you in its entirety. Journal entry number one, 1989. Our family is moving to Taiwan. Pretty cool. Well, that's all for now. Journal and final entry, number two, September 1994. Dear journal, wow, I haven't written in here very much. That's all I can think of to say. Bye. What word is the opposite of consistent, determined, faithful, habitual? What's the word that's the opposite of that? Because that is what I am. I excel at the opposite of consistent and determined and persevering and faithful and habitual. Today, I just want to orbit this one idea all morning as we're digging into what we're talking about, and it's just simply this: a life well lived is defined by ordinary faithfulness. A life well lived is defined by ordinary faithfulness. We're in the final leg of our Torah journey. We are 10 of 12 weeks into this. This is pretty incredible. And I know some of you feel a little embarrassed because you slip behind and you're like, Patrick, I'm still in Genesis. And it's okay. Any reading you do is awesome. If you just get a couple verses, I'm happy with that. If you are in Deuteronomy, as the journal charts us to be, I mean, gold star, you get to sit in the front row at church. That's incredible. That's really amazing if you've come that far. But what we're trying to challenge our church to do is read through the first five books of the Old Testament, which tend to be flyover country for most people. They start to read, and the Genesis stuff can be pretty interesting, but you get into Numbers, and you get into Leviticus, and then there's these genealogies, and there's these rules, and it gets confusing, and some of it's off-putting, and some of it reveals these stories that we don't know what to do with, because there's this violence, or God asks people to do things that seems inconsistent with his character, and so sometimes people just like say, I'm just going to skip that, I'm going to stay in the Psalms, or I'll stay in Proverbs, or just stick with the Old Testament. But we're doing it. We're in week 10 of week 12, and there's definitely been some challenging parts. So what we're going to do today is talk about the final book, and we're going to give you some tools to kind of grab hold of what's going on in this final book. And then in a few weeks, we're going to celebrate Easter Sunday. And I'm telling you, you're going to have a deepened appreciation for the sacrifice and the death and the resurrection of Christ because of what you've read through the Hebrew Bible. So as you wade into Deuteronomy, here's the setting. Here's the setting. So if you're not there yet, that's okay. Just file this stuff away. They are standing on the banks of the Jordan River from the east side, and they're looking into the promised land. They've been camping for 40 years. I don't want to be camping for 4 days, much less 40 years, unless camping involves like a cabin or a hotel, and I'm totally fine with that. I'll go out and I'll hike and I'll sit around a fire and then I'll go sleep in a normal bed. They've been camping for 40 years and they're on the banks of the Jordan River and they can see it and they can smell it. They can taste it. It is time. They are ready. You can imagine they're primed. You're imagining they're probably having to hold some people back. Like, hang on, we got to get our act together before we go over there. Now, if you're caught up with the story, you know that Moses, unfortunately, has been told he's not going to be allowed in. And it's a sad, tragic tale, but he's not going to get to go over there. He begs God a couple times, like, please let me. And God says, nope, this is not the plan for you. This is not how it's unfolding for you. So no, Moses knows that he's not going to get to go. In fact, Moses realizes it's the end of his life. And so he's got this crowd of people looking out over the promised land. And he stands up one last time to talk to them, to give them a rallying cry, to give them a speech. And the entire book, this is wild to think, the entire book of Deuteronomy is Moses' final words. It might even be one long speech, essentially. The whole book, all 34 chapters. There's a couple details in there, but for the most part, it's literally Moses verbalizing, this is what I want you to remember as you move into this land. It's his personal perspective, his take, his insight. Now, Deuteronomy is also the second law. The second law. And some of you are like, the second law? The first time it was hard enough. Why are they talking about the law again? Well, remember, this is 40 years after the first crowd, the first generation had been told by Moses from God what God's expectations were. It's 40 years later. I don't even know that some of you remember what I said last week. So it's no wonder that they could get up, Moses could get up and reiterate God's expectations to them, to a totally new generation 40 years later. It's not that strange. We read it and we're like, man, I just read this a couple books ago. What's going on? And by the way, most people that Moses was talking to didn't read or write. It was a very, communication was all verbal. They didn't have PowerPoint. They didn't send out emails. It was all verbal, and repetition was important. By the way, when you're reading the Hebrew Bible, specifically when you're reading these first five books of the Bible, pay attention to what gets repeated. That's like highlighting. That's bold. Those are headlines. Pay attention to what gets repeated in the text. And then this Deuteronomy, this is fascinating. I think this is amazing. It's the most quoted book by Jesus, the most quoted Old Testament book by Jesus. You know the story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. You remember that? He had three temptations and he had three responses. All three responses were direct quotes from the book of Deuteronomy. So as you read, note, oh, that's where Jesus got that. That's where Jesus said that. And then finally, Deuteronomy is a serious kick in the pants. That's the technical term again. This book is kind of like a Herb Brooks pregame speech. You remember the movie Miracle? I mean, this is a true story. Winter Olympics, 1980. Nobody expected the American hockey team to do anything, but Herb Brooks got the guys together in the locker room, and he just gave them the speech of the century, and they went out and they won gold. You remember that story? It's a movie. If you haven't watch it, you should watch it. It's just like, I don't even play hockey. I don't even really understand hockey. And I watch that movie and I'm like, ah, beat the Russians. You know, like, ah, you just get so wound up. It's such a good speech at the beginning of that movie. This is actually a picture of Kurt Russell. Some of you are like, that's not Herb Brooks. This is from the movie, Kurt Russell. Great moments are born from great opportunity. So you can imagine Moses wearing, you know, a plaid pants and a wide tie, getting up in front of everybody and saying, listen, everybody, this is our moment. Great moments are born of great opportunity. But Moses' whole thing, the truth that he's going to center around the whole time is this idea that a life well lived is one defined by ordinary faithfulness. And he's going to say, I don't want you crossing this river and going into this new place and forgetting about God and forgetting God's expectations and forgetting what God has done. Because it's a true danger. It's a real danger. Now, Moses, as he gets up to do his pregame pep talk, does not use the Herb Brooks, you got this method. There's no gentle parenting here. In fact, notice what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 1. Deuteronomy 1, verse 1. By the way, this verse is exactly what people are worried they're going to have to read when I ask them to read scripture on Sunday. They're like, it's just a bunch of names and it's just a bunch of places I don't know how to pronounce. I just say make it up, but I'm going to pronounce these all correctly just so you know this is the proper pronunciation. These are the words Moses spoke to all Israel in the wilderness east of the Jordan. That is in the Arabah, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizahab. So you don't know whether I pronounce those, whether I pronounce those correctly or not, do you? You don't know. Now those places mean nothing to us. We read that and we're like, this is why the Old Testament's hard. I don't know what any of that means. What's that supposed to be? But it's precise GPS coordinates for people who knew this area. He's telling him, this is where we were when I said these words. And he's calling to mind something that had happened almost 40 years earlier, because almost 40 years earlier, the first generation had been brought right to the edge of the promised land and they were ready to take it. And they decided, let's send in some spies and let's check this place out. The spies came back. 10 of them were like, it's a great place, but there's no way. It's occupied. We would have to do an eviction, and we cannot evict these people. And it made the whole nation scared, and God got upset. Remember the complaining that was always taking place. But look at verse 2. This is funny, and we're not going to notice that it's funny because it's Hebrew funny. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir Road. Verse 3. In the 40th year. Do you see what he just did? He was like, this is a trip that's supposed to take less than 2 weeks. 40 years later. Because we don't know these places. We don't know how long these trips are supposed to take. It doesn't make any sense to us. It would be like us saying, oh yeah, once my kid got their license, they got a little turned around. They were trying to get to downtown St. Paul and it's supposed to take 20 minutes from Woodbury to downtown St. Paul. 9 hours later, because they got lost. That's what's happening here. It's a little Hebrew roast of the people 40 years later. Now Moses starts by recounting. He starts his pep talk of do better by recounting the 40 years. The problem is in that 40 years, there's some ugly history. There's some bad stuff that's happened along the way. How is Moses going to inspire the people, given that a lot of bad things have happened? Is he going to say, well, as we all know, mistakes were made? Is he just going to be sort of opaque about the whole situation? You know, we've had our ups and downs. How's he going to handle the bad stuff in their history that has prevented them from getting to this point a little sooner? I've had to do a lot of funerals in my ministry career, particularly when we lived in Iowa. I had to do a lot of funerals. We were in a part of Iowa that was an elderly population, and people died relatively frequently. And for some reason, the local funeral director liked me a lot. And so when someone didn't have an officiant, he would call me. So I had to do a lot of funerals of people that I didn't know at all. And so when I didn't know the deceased, I relied on the family. I would go meet with the family before, or I'd certainly go to the visitation, and I would just ask the family, tell me about this person. You know, I want to make sure that we have a time of celebration. We can honor them. Tell me who they were. And most of the time, it was like, oh, Grandpa was awesome. Everybody loved him. He was so kind and gracious. The grandkids loved hanging around. Our grandma was so wonderful. She cooked everybody food all the time and took neighbors' stuff all the time. But every once in a while, I had to do a problematic funeral. Where you would meet with the family and they're like, yeah, nobody liked him. We're all kind of glad he's dead. Yeah, I know. Wow, exactly. You're like, what kind of guy was this grandpa? And so what do you do when all the information that you're getting about this individual is negative? Do I get up there and say, well, you know, the dearly departed was a horrible human being and we're really all glad that he's there and not still kicking around? No. What do you say? And so I would always try to say something like, well, you don't say Grandpa was just, you know, mean. You would say, well, as you know, Grandpa had some strong opinions, you know. You don't want to say he was racist. You don't want to say he was awful. But he had some strong, deeply held opinions. Or you don't want to say that Grandma had cut everyone out of the will. You just say, you know, Grandma had high standards. And everybody in the audience knew code what that meant, and they could all nod, and they could be like, yeah, she sure did. She was ridiculous. Moses doesn't do that. Moses doesn't try to cover over the flaws of the Hebrew people. He has the entire nation gathered there, and he goes right for the jugular. Look at what he says in later in the chapter, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 26. He says, listen, remember when we were here before 38 years ago? And it's interesting because this is the kids of the parents who were here before, but he just says you. He says, you were unwilling to go up. You rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You grumbled in your tents and said, the Lord hates us. So he brought us out of Egypt to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us. Now, even in that moment, Moses tried to pull them out of a nosedive and say, listen, we don't want to go there. Verse 29, then I said to you, listen, don't be terrified. Don't be afraid of them. The Lord your God, who is going before you, will fight for you as he did for you in Egypt before your very eyes. Now, remember, this is the children of the people who had been here. But he just paints everybody with the same brush. This is something that we have lost in our modern era of Christianity. But they didn't look at one person and say they were bad. If one person was bad, they collectively felt like, oh, that was all us. That's our collective guilt. So Moses said God was faithful to you. In spite of this, verse 32, you did not trust in the Lord your God who went ahead of you on your journey by fire by night and fire by night and cloud by day to search out places for you to camp and to show you the way you should go. When the Lord heard what you said, he was angry and solemnly swore, no one from this evil generation shall see the good land I swore to give your ancestors. It was a black mark on their collective history. And Moses starts his pep talk by reminding them of that. This is not motivation 101. This doesn't feel like a Tony Robbins seminar. This is like, what are you doing, Moses? I was thinking about this, like what if I use this as a parent? You know, I was trying to get Liam to dive off a high dive or something, and he does, and he just belly flops right on his face. He's red from head to toe, and I said, whoa, buddy, that was a disaster. That looked like it really hurt. I hope that doesn't happen again. Let's get back up there. It would be a tough way to motivate him. That was awful, buddy. I was thinking about if there's been times where I've had sermons, maybe more, I think that it happens more frequently maybe than other people do, but where I've like bombed a sermon, which I know sounds weird because how do you bomb a sermon? But when it just felt irrelevant, it felt like it didn't matter, it felt like everybody was asleep or whatever. And what if I felt terrible about how a sermon went and I go home and Corrine was like, oh, Patrick, I don't know if this is the career for you. I don't know. I do not know if you should get back up on that bike and ride. I don't know. It might be time to hang up the hat. Well, good luck next Sunday. Well, that would not inspire me. But that's essentially what Moses is doing here. Why does Moses immediately remind them of their failure? Why does he do that? Why does he do that? It's important that we understand this. Their failure, the collective Hebrew people's failure, was important to the point that he's trying to make to the whole book. Look at what he says, how he wraps up this little section, Deuteronomy 1:36. All of you were kicked out except Caleb, son of Jephunneh. He will see the land. I will give him and his descendants the land he set his feet on. Why? Because he followed the Lord wholeheartedly. Moses is saying, okay, class, what's the difference between that entire generation and Caleb? The way he followed God, his faithfulness. Right from the beginning, right from the first chapter of Deuteronomy, a life well lived is defined by ordinary faithfulness. What is ordinary faithfulness? We're a smart enough audience to know what ordinary faithfulness is. But Moses is going to show us anyway. The most single well-known passage from Deuteronomy, and maybe, honestly, maybe the most single well-known or well-used phrase in religious history, not just Hebrew religious history, but in all of religious history, is in Deuteronomy. And it's in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, where Moses says this phrase that the Hebrew people turned into a daily prayer, recited to this day, has been recited for millennia. where he says this, "Hear, O Israel." Hear isn't just listen. It's like listen, respond, obey. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments," and there's going to be a lot of them in Deuteronomy, "that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols in your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and your gates." Now, there have been hundreds, thousands, millions of sermons written about these words because Jesus reiterated them later in the New Testament when someone said, "Hey, what's the greatest command?" He said, "It's love the Lord your God with everything," which is why we know Jesus quoted the book of Deuteronomy more than just about anywhere else. So we could spend weeks isolating, well, what does it mean with all your might and all your heart and all your soul? And that's fine. But I think what Moses is just saying, kind of in a fancy, flowery way, is he's just saying, hey, love God with everything. And I heard it put this way, and I thought this was so good and so memorable. Ordinary faithfulness is this. It is all of life for all your life. That's what Moses is saying. Every bit of who you are and what you do is to be an act of love to God for the entirety of your existence. All of life for all your life. Ordinary faithfulness, there's no secret. There's no magic pill. It doesn't matter if you're a person on a stage preaching to an audience or if you're sitting listening and you've got a 9-to-5 during the week. It's the unsung virtue of consistency. Just every day deciding that with this day, I am going to love and honor and obey God. That's all it is. I'm going to wake up and I'm going to pray. And I'm going to honor my spouse, and I'm going to love my family, and I'm going to parent, and I'm going to deny sin. It's just doing that every single day. That's what it is. That's what it is to love God. I'm going to tell you an offensive story, and it's not offensive because it's inappropriate for church. It's inoffensive because you're going to be mildly annoyed with me for telling it, because it's going to feel like I'm indicting some of you. It's going to feel like you're getting in trouble. And we can wrestle with the particulars of the story, but I want to tell you the story about ordinary faithfulness because I think it matters to who we are and to how God interacts with us. A good friend of mine, his name is Billy Wallace. Some of you have met him. He actually ministers about 2 hours from here in Alexandria. Now, he's been quite a few different places. But he told this story years ago, and I actually called him this week just to make sure I had the particulars right, you know, because it just went into one of those things, nothing wild or crazy or outlandish, but just one of those things that just kind of sunk deeply when he told it. Just, it's always stuck with me, and every time I think about this topic, I think about this story from Billy. He played high school baseball. Billy played high school baseball, and he was pretty good. You wouldn't know it to look at him now, which I hope Billy watches this later, but he was good. He was good enough that a scout came to watch a friend of his play in high school, and Billy had the game of his career, and the scout talked to him about playing for their school, and he had this opportunity to get some scholarship money to play baseball at the next level. I don't know, it was probably a terrible baseball school, but anyway, whatever. I don't want to give Billy too much credit here, is what I'm trying to do. Now, this is unusual, but this was Oregon back in the 80s and 90s, but a lot of Billy's baseball games happened on a Wednesday night. And for decades, there was a lot of churches that had Wednesday night services, and we typically do too, depending on where we are in the year. But Billy's family went to church on Wednesday night, so his dad told them, "Listen, you can play right up until it's time for us to get to church and be there on time," which meant that for Billy, that he could play about to the middle of the fourth inning. And Billy was pretty good. He was pretty good. He was valuable to the team. So about the middle of the fourth inning, his dad, who was sitting in the stands, would give him the signal, and Billy knew it was time to go. And Billy hated it. He hated it. He hated abandoning his team in the middle of the game. He hated the fact that, can't I just stay? Can't we just get to church late? And the value system that his parents had at the time were like, nope, this is our number one priority. We are going to abandon baseball for Wednesday night services. And again, this is the part some of you are like, you could debate that. I understand that. But Billy hated it. He hated it. But Billy knew that his dad was an immovable force. There was no arguing with him. And so Billy would do everything he could in his, in what little power that he held to make it clear to his father and everybody around him that he was not on board with this decision. He would leave the dugout. He would be dragging his stuff behind him. He would be slouching. He would intentionally not bring a change of shoes so that he would have to wear his cleats at church and it would make the loudest possible noise on the linoleum floor. So every step was, I don't want to be here, don't want to be here, don't want to be here. Everything he could do to let everybody know that he didn't want to be here. In one game, Billy, he was 15 years old at the time, and he happened to be pitching, kind of a rare opportunity, and he was pitching well. His team was up 2-1 at the bottom of the fourth inning. His dad gave him the signal, and Billy knew, there's no arguing, starts trudging towards his dad's truck, and the coach said, Billy, please don't leave. Please don't leave. I don't have anybody else that can pitch. But Billy is like, shrugged his shoulders, what is he going to do? He finds out at school the next day that his team lost 20-2. Lost 20-2. He hated it. Now, we can debate the merits of skipping baseball for Wednesday nights, and everybody has to work out for themselves how their faith is going to define their lives. But listen, some of you let other people and other influences define that for you, and you should not. You should make that decision. Yeah. You should not let anybody else tell you how you are going to live out your faith. But you do. Because maybe faith isn't, ordinary faithfulness isn't central to who you are. Maybe. And this is the part I told you, you're going to be offended. Patrick, well, you don't know our circumstances. I do not know your circumstances. I don't know what's going on in your lives. But this is the part we can debate and we can talk. Every family has to work that out. But Billy's family believed that this is what ordinary faithfulness looked like. And Billy's dad impressed that upon his children as they drove to church and as they were at home and as they argued about whether or not Billy would leave in the fourth inning. Billy's dad did the Deuteronomy 6 thing. And by the way, some of you are like, well, yeah, but you're going to make your kid resent church. If you make them do something they don't want to do, they're going to resent it. Do you make your kids brush their teeth? Do you make them take showers and baths? I mean, do they resent it? Yes, some of them resent it very much, but you make them do it anyway. Not only did this practice not push Billy away, when he graduated from high school, he didn't go play baseball. He went to Bible college, and he has given his life to ministering. Because for a period of time, his parents had to be his faithfulness. Because he wasn't. That wasn't who he was. He's worked his entire adult life doing this. One of my closest friends. He's got a lot of mileage out of this story as well. I don't know what it's going to look like for you, but I do know that a life well lived is defined by ordinary faithfulness. All right. Maybe you're sitting here saying, okay, all right, I'll figure it out. I'll work it out. But what is this going to look like? How do I pursue this? Moses has got some things to say. We're going to look at these two things as we begin to wrap this up. Number one, God's faithfulness fuels our faithfulness. God's faithfulness fuels our faithfulness. A few weeks ago, completely by chance, I happened to be at a church conference in Joplin, Missouri, and I was in the men's bathroom just exiting, and I saw a person that I haven't seen for 25 years in the men's bathroom. His name is Ted Skiles. He's over here on the left here, and here's his wife, Bev. We were supposed to call them Uncle Ted and Aunt Bev. I've known them since I was a little kid. Sorry about my big face right there in the middle. I apologize. I should have photoshopped that out. But I was in the bathroom, and Uncle Ted walks in, and he looks exactly the same as he did when I was a 12, 13-year-old kid in Taiwan. They ran an orphanage over there for 55 years. I said, Uncle Ted, and I gave him a big hug, and he had no idea who I was. I'm just a guy hugging another guy in a men's bathroom. Fortunately, I had a name tag, and kind of as he pulled away, he realized, he's like, oh, you know, and it all came together. He's just over 80 now, and we were able to reconnect. I got to go to their house for lunch, and it was just wonderful. They look exactly the same. I don't know how they've done it, what kind of magic they're doing, but they look exactly the same as they did when I was 12 years old. It's pretty wild. But anyway, I had lunch with them. And I just said, you know, when you're a 12, 13-year-old kid, you're not that curious. And I realized I had no idea how they got to Taiwan, why they were there, why they were running an orphanage, why they had given 55 years of their life to this. I didn't know any of that. And so I asked him, and we had this lunch conversation where he explained some of the details. And it's super interesting, super fascinating, won't recount it all. But I did want to share one detail about their story of moving from Missouri to Taiwan, or I guess technically Oklahoma to Taiwan. He had just graduated from Bible college. They had three kids. He had done Bible college a little bit later in life. And usually when you're going through Bible college and you're looking for a church to work at, it means you are broke. B-R-O-K-E, broke. You have no money. You have nothing. They had this opportunity. Somebody had said, hey, we need people to come work in Taiwan. And they felt convicted, compelled to go do that. But they had no way of getting there. They just didn't, so they just prayed, God, what do we do? How do we get there? So a friend of theirs said, why don't we just go down to the travel agent? You don't Google how to get to Taiwan back in 1967. So they went down to the travel agent, and they said, what is the absolute rock bottom, cheapest way to get us, us two and our three kids over to Taiwan to do some mission work? And the person said, oh yeah, by ship. You can float there. But it's $1,200 for your whole family to get there by ship. It's a lot of money in 1967 when you have no money. And the travel agent said, actually, we can get you on a boat here in the next couple weeks, but you have to have $376 as a down payment. They don't have any money. $1,200 sounds like about a bazillion dollars. $376, just forget about it. Where are you going to get any of that? Well, when God wants you to do something, he's going to make it happen. Knock on the door, stranger. Felt compelled to give you a check. $400. God must be answering this. But $400, God, we only needed $376. We don't need $400, but that's very generous of you. Maybe we can go out to eat and say goodbye to our friends and family before we go on this journey. But somebody reminded them, when you move to a foreign country, you have to have a passport to get there. And they're like, oh, yes, of course. Back in the day, this is what they're telling me, you didn't have to have a passport for the kids, but just for the parents. So they needed two passports. The fee was $12 per passport, $24, $376 plus $24, $400. Here's the means. Now I'm listening to that story over 57 years later. I'm listening to him recount that story of God's faithfulness in their lives. And he said things like that happened all the time. And it's inspiring me. God's faithfulness in their lives half a century ago is giving me fuel to live faithfully right now. God's faithfulness fuels our faithfulness. And by the way, some of you are now fueled by God's faithfulness in a stranger's life that you've never met. You've only seen a picture of. You're fueled by that. You're fueled by what God did in their lives, and it's going to encourage you to be more faithful. And then you're going to have stories of God's faithfulness in your lives to share with other people. Look at what Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 8. This is a little bit later. He says, remember. He's up in front of the people. Remember how the Lord, God, your God, led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years. He humbled you. He tested you in order to know what was in your heart. Remember last week we said God had gotten them out of Egypt, but God needed to get Egypt out of them. He wanted to know whether or not you would keep his commands, and you failed every step of the way. He didn't say that, but that's what happened. He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known. He provided daily bread, literally provided daily bread for you, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone. Where have I heard that phrase before? Seems like something Jesus might have said. But on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord, look at this, what it is. This is God's faithfulness in their lives. Your clothes did not wear out. It's pretty wild. Any of you have children? Your clothes did not wear out in those 40 years in the wilderness. Your feet did not swell. I don't know if that's a thing, but I guess if you're walking around a lot. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord your God disciplines you because he's faithful. God's faithfulness fuels our faithfulness. Number two, God's faithfulness frees us from perfectionism. And this is really important for us to know, particularly if you've grown up in and around Churches of Christ. God's faithfulness frees us from perfectionism. It's really easy to misread Moses here. Really easy. It seems like he's bringing up their failure to kind of rub it in their faces, and we hate that. We as human beings hate to admit any failure because what if it gets used later in an argument against us? Have you ever had arguments with your spouse or loved ones about, oh, who left the garage door open? Who left the oven on? That one thing you did wrong that one time 20 years ago and somehow it still comes up in the arguments. Oh, who gave all our savings to a scammer? Oh, who said that their mom's chili was better than mine? I didn't do that. I did not do that. I just want you to know. We don't like to admit that we messed up because when we mess up, it feels like it goes on our permanent record and somebody might bring it up in every future argument. So we tend to think Moses, when we hear a life well lived, we tend to think, well, it should be defined by always being right. Not ordinary faithfulness, but always being right. Moses, this is so good. Church Christ folks, this is so good. This is so important for you to see this, particularly to see it in the Old Testament. If you're not Church of Christ, there's versions of this in every different group, by the way. Moses points out their failures to show them that even at their very worst, God has been faithful. Even at their very worst, God has been faithful. This is crucially important, and this is the part. As I'm writing notes and I'm studying, this is the part that I'm like, oh, I want our church to hear this. I'm so sad that there are people driving and aren't hearing this, and people on spring break that aren't hearing this, and I hope they listen later because this is what our church needs to hear. Perfectionism, which I think is closely related to fundamentalism and legalism, is always a dead end. Because when Christians in those kinds of environments inevitably mess up, because we mess up. Perfectionism says, oh, there's a flaw in my track record. I have to do one of two things. One, I could never, ever, ever admit this to another person. I can never confess it, and I can never experience the joy of repentance because I can't confess this sin because somebody's going to hold it against me. Or if my sin does get out, if I do mess up, well, now I've messed up. Why try? Why try to dust myself off and get better and do better next time? Because I've messed up once. And now there's a flaw. There's a black mark on my track record. Listen, God does not love you because of your perfect track record. He never has. God does not love you because of how you present to other people. And just because you can fool somebody into thinking you've got it all together, that doesn't make God love you more. God's not confused by that. Is God giving the promised land to Israel because they're so good? No. Look at what he says, Deuteronomy 9:5. It is not because of your righteousness, let's make this very clear, people, or your integrity that you are going to take possession of the land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations, God is judging them. The Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What's God saying? That he is faithful. Now, just in case there's any confusion, he says it again, verse 6. Understand then, it is not because of your righteousness that your Lord your God is giving you this land to possess, for you are a stiff-necked people. It is not because you're good, it is because God is good. Right. It's not because you're perfect, it's because God is perfect. None of us are here because we're good. What's the line, Freddie Mercury? And bad mistakes, I've made a few, right? That's us. We're only here because God is faithful. And the New Testament authors picked up on that theme. There are several places they say this. Paul says this one time, that if we are faithless, he says it in 2 Timothy, if we are faithless, God is faithful, for he cannot disown himself. So God is not looking for perfection. By the way, God is not looking for perfection because he already took care of perfection in Jesus Christ. God is looking for faithfulness. let's wrap this up. I've already gone over time, but man, I felt like you needed to hear some stuff. I still feel like you need to hear some stuff. I got some more stuff to say, but we're going to have to save it for some other time. We usually know what we should do. We usually do. We're just not doing it. We lack desire. We become distracted. We need someone to come along and give us a good kick in the pants. We need someone to come along and say, listen, this is, you got to get it together. And there will be a point when it matters. This idea of ordinary faithfulness, a life well lived is defined by ordinary faithfulness, because there's a particular verse that's been ringing in my mind this whole week, and it's Matthew 25:23, where Jesus, telling a parable, invites the servant, well done. That's the words you want to say, you want to hear said to you at the end of your life. Well done, my good and perfect servant. My good and faithful servant. We're going to close in a song. I'm going to invite the praise team to come back up, and we're going to stand and sing a song called Step by Step. And that's what it is. It's ordinary faithfulness, just one step at a time. You're not trying to run the whole marathon right now. You're just taking one step at a time, one foot in front of the other. And so you have to ask yourself, what is the next step for you? What is the next brick in the building of your life that God is calling you to? Step by step. Let's stand together as we sing.